I think I must say at the outset that the request was very broad from the committee, and as a result, the presentation is fairly long, but I will try and go through it fairly quickly as well. But we'll try to give you quite a comprehensive overview of the issues we're dealing with. So, if we look at the slide 2, and I hope Honourable members have copies of the presentation. In slide 2, we outline the presentation, which is the purpose, the vision, mission, strategic objectives of the department, key legislation the department works on, the issue. Of the structure of the department, the skills audit of the department, then strategic budgeting information, and then we then start raising some of the areas where we have challenges with regard to budgets and other issues, and these are key benefits, education support, healthcare support, SRD, the issue of the pension, committee has raised with us for a while, the issue of empowerment and honouring of military veterans, the development of a service delivery and stakeholder management, service delivery challenges and the mitigation strategies, the governance, risk compliance and mitigation strategies, protocol agreements with other organs of state, and areas of intra-governmental integration. So, and then the conclusion. The purpose of the presentation is to appraise the Joint Standing Committee of Defence about the status of the Department of Military Veterans on its performance and the delivery of military veterans benefits as included in Section 5.1 of the Act. The vision and mission of the department, the vision is a dignified, unified, empowered, and self-sufficient military veterans community. The mission is to facilitate delivery and coordinate all activities that recognize and entrench the restoration of dignity and appreciation of the contribution of military veterans to our freedom and nation building. The strategic objectives of the department, which are also outlined in the NSET documents and in the APPs of the department. Firstly, recognizing and honoring military veterans in life and memorializing them in death for the sacrifices on behalf of the nation. Secondly, improving the quality of life for military veterans and that of their dependents. Thirdly, providing a comprehensive delivery system of benefits and services for military veterans. Fourthly, to strengthen the structures, systems, policies, processes, and procedures of the department. Fifthly, ensuring a smooth and seamless transition of military veterans from active military service to civilian life. Sixthly, ensuring that military veterans are a resource to enhance the national workforce and contribute to the prosperity and development of the country. And lastly, contributing to towards reconciliation and nation building. If we look at the legislative review, the department is currently implementing the Military Veterans Act 18 of 2011. We had begun a process to amend the Act. The process actually began in 2015, but during last year, the department signed off on the draft amendments, which were also signed off by the minister. The next public process would be then to publish the amendments for comment, publish it by the department, and once that's done, it would be to submit it to cabinet and then to parliament, so the parliament can take forward the process. However, the process internally is not finalized. We are required to do a socio-economic impact assessment on the proposed amendment. We've been working with DPME on that, but there have been challenges inside the department to finalize that process. At the same time, the department needs to review and write new regulations around for the military veterans benefit. There's some gaps in the regulations currently. There's no regulation on education, and this is an issue that's been raised by the Auditor General that we need a regulation on education support. And further, there are some other issues that require clarity in the regulation. So that would be part of the responsibility of the new acting DG to ensure that we deal with those issues. That will also strengthen the compliance environment in the department, because then we will have a full set of regulations for all the policies that we're trying to. The next slide is the strategy map of the department. I'm not going to spend time on that, but it just outlines how the different policy and delivery aspects get held together. This slide is the current approved organizational structure of the department at a macro level. One of the issues that yourselves have been raising with us, it's also raised in the TSI report, and it's also an important issue internally in the department, is whether the current structure allows effective service delivery to military veterans. I think I'm going to make a couple of points about the current structure. The first point I want to make is that when the structure was approved, and this also affects the lower parts of the current approved structure, which are not reflected in the slide, that the majority of posts in the department were created in the branch corporate services. So more than two-thirds of the current posts in the department are in one branch. And then the other two branches, which actually deliver services, share the posts. So there's an imbalance in the current structure in that the two service delivery branches, which actually deliver services, are not capacitated to deliver. So it's vital, if we are to deliver services effectively, that we completely restructure the department. Also, as you can see, the structure was approved in 2010 whilst the department was being established, and it doesn't take into account changes that might have taken place in terms of what we need to deliver and the level of delivery that's required. I'll give one simple example. We provide education support. In 2015-16, we were given education support to less than 1,000 applicants. Today, there are more than 10,000 applicants. But the human resource capacity of that branch to deal with those has not changed. So the same number of people are dealing with less than 1,000 applicants are now having to deal with more than 10,000. And so it's vital that we urgently make changes. The second point that I wanted to make about the structure is that internally the department has shifted some posts around. But some of those shifts are now not useful for the delivery of the department. So some of the posts which were in the service delivery branches were actually a few years ago shifted to other areas. And now we need them back in the service delivery branch, but people are in those parts. So it's urgent to deal with structure. We have been busy with that process. We have EXCO's approved the draft structure. There was also some work done on the service delivery model last year. We've been pushing this year to try and get some finality. We've held a meeting with DPSA and National Treasury in April to begin the process of working together and to have their advice. Of course, those are the two departments that we require buy-in for the proposed structure, because DPSA must approve it and National Treasury must fund the new structure. So we're working from the beginning with them on the process. A project team was also established within the department to review the service delivery model, because the structure must relate to the service delivery model. And then the EMV team has met and has begun the process. They're working on the basis that structure follows process, follows strategy. So we need to get the strategy right, then the processes, and then that will help us finalize the strategy. Okay. So to my mind, there's also an urgency in this, because the funding cycles are very, in government, are very defined. So we will go now into the new MTEP funding cycle for the coming year and then the following year. That process is finalized largely around September. So if we want funding for next year for a new structure, then we need to be able to propose something into that process. Otherwise, the new structure will only come in, not in the coming financial year, but the year thereafter, which will continue to affect service delivery in the department. The department has also responded to the call of the committee and from other areas to conduct a skills audit of employees. We have secured a service provider for the skills audit, and the process will begin next week of them interviewing staff members. We had to postpone it by about 2 weeks. They will begin their process. If we look at then go on to the performance information and expenditure, we're giving you a snapshot of the 2017-18 financial year. I just want to stress that this is currently unaudited. The Auditor General is busy auditing the financial statement and performance information we provided to them on the 31st of May. Basically looks at the unaudited information we provided to the AG. If we look at the budget allocations, the total allocation for the 17-18 financial year was 622.1 million rand, and the department managed to spend 97% of that budget, which members will remember is a significant increase from previous years. In 2016-17, the department had only spent 59% of the budget, and in 16-17, we then spent 85% of the budget, and we're now at 97%. So, significant improvement in that, and I think there's a lot of congratulations on that, in particular the processes that have been led by the CFO. And then the slide also indicates the breakdown of the appropriation and the percentage spend from each of the branches. We've also then indicated the proposed budget for the MTEP period going forward as received from National Treasury, and what honourable members will notice is that the numbers reflect the 5% cut that National Treasury has implemented in all departments, and DMV hasn't been spared that cut, which obviously will put more pressure on the department going forward. The next slide looks at the same information with a different slide, looking at the economic classification. So what we'll see here is the expenditure on compensation of employees, and you'll notice spend there 99%, goods and services, spend of 94%, and transfers and subsidies 99%. Capital expenditure, you'll see that the amounts that were allocated for capital expenditure were very small, and that we achieved 67% expenditure there. That's largely due to the fact that we had taken a decision at the beginning of the last calendar year that we should first get our supply chain processes in order before we engage in procurement of capital goods. So we finalized in March last year the supply chain policy of the department. We've also then established new supply chain committees, the evaluation, adjudication, etc., specification committee. And we've tried to ensure that that's all done in terms of laws and regulations to ensure that when we do procurement, that it's compliant and that we don't face the challenges that we're facing still with previous procurement that were done with the department, that some of which are in court. Then if we go to some of the benefits and the issues we've been facing in the delivery of benefits, the first one is education support, and this is the benefit where there's been a massive increase in applications. There's also been a massive increase in the actual support that's been given to military veterans and their dependents. But the administration of this, benefit, I'm sure honourable members would know, is that we are facing serious capacity challenges in providing the benefit, approving applications, and paying for the applications that are approved. And we try to take urgent steps to resolve those issues. As I said earlier, they're largely problems relating to capacity, human capacity to deal with the issues. We've also, because of the massive increase in the number of applicants, and also due to some issues we've had with spending on certain other benefits, we shifted significant amounts of money to cover the education support benefits. However, one of the problems we face is that is not sustainable because as we the processes are put in place to deal with the rollout of other benefits, we won't be able to shift away from them to education support. Also, honourable members will understand that in the budgeting process, normally budgets are increased by small amounts, maybe the inflation rates, also, and in this period of cuts to budgets to departments, in fact, often budgets for line items are actually reduced. Now, what we're looking here is the requirement for more than 100% increase in specific budgets for this, somewhere around 100 to 150% increase that we require. So this requires also more engagement with National Treasury that we can properly budget in this regard. Obviously, that requires proper planning from the department, but it also requires that we're going to get that support. I think that the committee, the executive authority, and the department would have to work together to engage National Treasury to get the required budget. In terms of the heading, let me just apologize, it's a slight mistake. The NTSF outcome is outcome one, not 1 and 4, and it's headed quality basic education. And then the numbers, in the previous financial year, that's in 17-18 financial year, we finally approved 7,712 applications for education. number of applicants we have and we're busy processing this year is 10,557. So you can see the large increase there. We've also had some really significant successes in the education support, and to date at a higher education level, 148 beneficiaries have graduated from universities, 74 of whom have graduated in the last academic year, and I'm sure the numbers for basic education are much higher. As I said, there is management capacity problems in dealing with these issues. We still sit in a situation where some approvals and payments, a large number of them are not finalized for this year. But we've been trying to make interventions to ensure that we can complete that process as soon as possible. Then if we look at healthcare support, it's related to NTSS outcome 2. This is aware that currently that what the department does is provide access to healthcare through the military health facility. This is not an ideal situation. The department had planned previously to procure a service provider who would assist with the provision of healthcare. Unfortunately, that contract was cancelled due to non-compliance with the prescript. That there is currently a court case in that regard. We are still awaiting the date for the case. We've tried to negotiate with the service provider, the negotiation, because we wanted to negotiate an out-of-court settlement so that we could resolve the case as soon as possible, and then we would be then able to move forward to look at other procurements for a service provider. Unfortunately, we were not able to reach a settlement out of court, so the matter is still on the awaiting a court date. Now, that puts us in a position, as long as this contract is in court, we're unable to procure another service provider. So it's likely the current situation will continue until the court case is resolved. Some of the challenges we've experienced in using SAN is that let me say that what the department does is issues a card to qualifying military veterans, which they can then use at SAN's facilities. So that's how we provide the access. We have a MOU with SAN and a service level agreement, but we experiencing some challenges there. There's a challenge with the level of services provided to SAN. I think they also have their own challenges. So, for instance, one of the big issues is the provision of medicine. Medicine is prescribed, but can't be dispensed, often in many cases. The second challenge is around transporting of military veterans to hospitals and clinics. Previously, the service was provided by SANS. No longer provided by SANS, and the department is struggling to provide a compliant service which would include the different levels of transport. Sometimes all you need is to take someone to a clinic or a hospital, but on other occasions you need high care transport. For instance, the person has had an operation or is in an emergency, and we try to fit those. And then one of the other challenges we've experienced is the issue of invoicing from SANS. In the past, there were big delays in providing invoices for services and a big backlog built up of the invoices. More recently, what's been happening is large numbers of invoices have been arriving at DMV at once. So it takes us a long time to then process those things. And of course, that also has an impact because we're meant to pay invoices after 30 days. But if we receive like thousands of invoices in 1 month, and other months we don't receive any invoices, it puts a lot of capacity challenges on us to but we are working through that, and we've processed most of the invoices we've received. Unfortunately, the impact on us is that we have a large number of accruals from the previous year. Then go to social relief of distress. Social relief of distress relates to the MTSF outcome 13, which in this case really relates to the issue of food security for military veterans. SRD is not a benefit listed in the Act. It was rolled out due to a ministerial intervention and instruction a few years ago. I must say SRD and the provision of SRD creates a large number of problems for DMV, and it's not an appropriate a benefit for DMV to be rolling out. To our mind, the SRD issues would largely be resolved if DMV could implement the military pension, because that would then, we would then, rather than providing like a small amount for relief of distress, we'd be providing a pension which would cover, which would be at a higher level and cover more of the issues that military veterans are facing. In 2017-18, 2,832 military veterans and their dependents were provided with SRD to mitigate their suffering. There were problems in the implementation, which are due to the policy guideline that had been adopted previously, which says that before receiving the benefit, veterans must be assessed by a social worker who must recommend the benefit, and then for the assistance, and that the duration of the assistance is 12 months. So people shouldn't receive it for more than 12 months. Now, initially, those policy guidelines were not implemented. The department did not have social workers to do the assessment, so we then employed social workers during last year, and then tasked them to do the assessment. Military veterans resisted this, and in many cases chased social workers away, and there's a general view amongst military veterans that the social workers are there to take them off the benefits and so on. It's our, we have some understanding which needs further investigation, but it does also come out of the assessment that the military, that the social workers have done, that there's a large amount of fraud in relation to a large number of veterans who do not qualify for the assistance are receiving it because the procedures were not in place to properly assist them. And I think a lot of the resistance to the social workers is because that would lead to an exposure of people who shouldn't be receiving it. And then also previously people had received for more than 12 months, and as we implemented that, it created problems. We have looked at this in quite a lot of detail, as I mentioned about the pension. In terms of SRD, we've also discussed whether we can engage with social development to see whether they can take responsibility for this area, but that engagement still needs to take place. And then also one of the issues we've raised that we need to implement is to look at, in the period where veterans are receiving SRD, what other interventions can DMV make to capacitate them so that they can create their own? And that would largely be around skills development and perhaps business support. So there needs to be more integration between the CES branch that deals with SRD and the ESM branch that deals with skills development. So that those who are on SRD, we ensure that they receive skills training to make themselves Then I've briefly mentioned the pension already. The department is not here to deliver this benefit. There had been some work done about 4 years ago, but it was never brought to fruition. The department needs to develop, to do research and finalize the approach to the delivery of the pension, and then a regulation and policy needs to be developed, and then for potential rollout in the next financial year. The executive authority is very strongly with us, the need for us to focus on this benefit. And as I said earlier, hopefully the rollout of the pension, if we structure it in the right way, it will reduce demands for other benefits. Then, in terms of the empowerment of military veterans, this arises out of the MTSF Outcome 5, which is headed a skilled, capable workforce to support an inclusive growth path. In the past year, 114 military veterans were provided with access to business empowerment opportunities. Honorable members will know that the preferential procurement regulations were changed last year by National Treasury, and they now also designate military veterans as a designated group in terms of preferential procurement. We've been in contact with National Treasury, in particular with the Central Supplier Database, so that we can provide and verify information that will be on the database indicating the military veteran status. That process needs to be finalized, but it will significantly help DMV because what it will mean is that as all national departments are using the Central Supplier Database, they will immediately be able to, on the database, know which are military veteran-owned companies and then apply their own preferential policies in that regard. And then the department still has a lot of work to engage with DOD and other organs of state to give further support to military veterans, and we have started those engagements. Various levels in DOD and in Arms Corps, and we need to also engage with other parastatals and other organizations. In terms of honoring military veterans, MTSF Outcome 14 talks about nation building, social cohesion, so does the MP chapter. In the past financial year, 272 families of military veterans were provided with burial support. I want to stress this is one area where we have been implementing a means test. In the, of course, the means test is in the Act, it's also in our policy as well, but it does, I think the committee is aware of the contentious nature of the means test. In terms of the issues that are in the ADP, there have been no new developments on the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier during the prior financial year, but the issue remains a priority that the executive authority has raised with us. We also, in the previous year, launched a pilot project on the erection of headstones on graves of military veterans that were already in place. But those graves did not have headstones. 20 headstones have been erected at graves. We used this as a pilot project, and we've identified some issues in terms of the rollout of the project, and the branch is dealing with it so that we can move from the pilot to a full rollout in that regard. We've also worked with the Department of Justice and Correctional Services, with the Missing Persons Task Team to provide support on the handover of the remains of freedom fighters who were hung and largely their remains were buried in secret by the apartheid regime. As you know, the Missing Persons Task Team those graves and handing over the remains to families. We've worked on two projects with former FOCO members, and we will continue to do that. So when the handovers are done and the burials are done, it's done jointly between the two departments, and then the burials become the responsibility of the TOT in terms of the burials. Let me just say, in terms of the PAL FOCO group, there are still some more burials to take place in that regard. Then, in terms of the service delivery model and stakeholder management, I've mentioned the overall about the service delivery model. One of the big concerns that management has is that currently we have one head office in Hatfield in Victoria, and we only have three offices. We only have offices in three provinces. And this puts a huge pressure on military veterans, this puts a pressure on the officials of the department, because large numbers of military veterans feel the need to come to Pretoria to engage with the department, and that's not appropriate. So the aim is to decentralize service delivery centers in all provinces. As I say, we succeeded in three. We've engaged 2 weeks ago with Public Works, but the situation still remains without any real solution in the other provinces from Public Works. And I think we've raised the issue very strongly. We have also engaged with other organs of state to assist us, but that needs to be developed further in that regard. We continue to engage with our stakeholders. I think honourable members are aware that in the Military Veterans Association, there have been a number of divisions in various of the associations, including in SANDA, but the term of office of the current National Executive of SANDA is coming to an end, and SANDA is have a conference in this year. Their term of office is 5 years. So that would be key that the department insists that that office creates greater unity amongst military veterans. Then, in terms of agreements with other organs of state, which flows on from the previous slide, we have taken an agreement in order to assist with decentralization of service delivery, that we should engage with provincial governments. We've started in Mpumalanga in Eastern Cape. We have a signed agreement now with the Eastern Cape provincial government, and we had a roadshow in February to begin the rollout of that agreement, and it was very successful. We went jointly with provincial government departments to various districts in the Eastern Cape, and that was also a bit of a pilot for us, and I think we've learned some of the lessons from that, and that needs to be rolled out into other provinces. We've engaged Mpumalanga, and we've sent them a draft agreement. We are waiting for them to sign it and send it back to us, and we've begun engagements with Gauteng and Northwest Provincial Government to enter into these agreements. Besides with us with accommodation and things like that, the key thing we want to look at is, say, for instance, many of our benefits are actually responsibilities of provincial government, like education. Basic education is provided by provincial departments of education, basic education. Healthcare services in the country are rolled out by provincial government. So we want to see how we can use those services of provincial government to prioritize services for military veterans. Amongst the things we're looking at is to ensure placement of military veterans and their dependents in schools which provide high quality education in public schools, and how we facilitate the payment of that. In terms of healthcare, to have military veterans fast tracked through provincial healthcare facilities, so they don't have to stand in long lines. So That would also help improve our authenticity. What we also have identified is that we need to really focus on the provinces that have the largest number of military veterans. There are three provinces in that regard: Eastern Cape, Gauteng, and KZN. As I said, we dealt with the Eastern Cape. We started to engage with Gauteng. We still need to go to KZN. But if we could get those things right in those three provinces, we would really be dealing with the largest number. And there are provincial and local governments that have allocated and provided support to military veterans themselves. Some provincial governments have officials in the office of the Premier who are working on military veteran issues. That's true in KZN, Gauteng, KZN, and other provinces. Benefits. We still don't have this right. We have been strengthening communication. communication with partners, and we've been trying to increase our own project management ability, but there's more work to be done. With regard to NSFAS, for instance, we've now employed an official who is a DMV official that will be based at NSFAS head office to help us have direct communication with their officials and processes. And then we also would recommend a review of service delivery models for the provision of housing. I think the honourable members are aware of the problem. We also have a challenge with regard to our head office building. The building is too small for the current number of staff members, and we have to put partitions and desks and wires all over the place just to accommodate the staff that we have. Does not create favorable working conditions. We are engaged in two kind of parallel processes of public work. The one is a long-term solution to find an appropriate head office, which would either have to be built specifically for the department, or we would take over the offices of another department to be refurbished for us. That's a long-term process, probably taking 5 years. However, we need an interim solution because our lease also expires in November, and the current building, besides the capacity of the building for staff members, the building is insecure, and it's not easy to secure the building. It only has essentially one entrance and exit, and honourable members would know about the illegal occupations, marches, which put the safety of staff members at risk, and also have led us in February to actually close the head office for 2 weeks due to an illegal occupation. So part of the problem there is the structure of the building, which means also we don't have a service centre to service veterans applying coming to the building. We've had to create a temporary service centre, which is in our cafeteria and in our auditorium, which correctly military veterans complain about. The air conditioning is not there, there's not proper seating, etc., etc. It's not appropriate. But we have to separate the servicing of military veterans from the back office function. Because what is happening in the past is military veterans coming to the offices where officials are processing applications, and when they're unhappy, they then disrupt the whole office, and that leads to processing stop, being stopped. And so we need to separate the two aspects. I'm really hoping that public works will come to the party, and maybe it's appropriate for the portfolio committee to go back to the engagement we had in, I think, November last year with public works. And then I've mentioned the provincial office space. We have 3 functioning offices in Northwest and Cape Mpumalanga. We need to have certainty from public works when they provide that. Then just in risk governance compliance issues, spoken about the alignment of the structure with the delivery requirements, finalized organizational structure, the issue of internal information management systems, financial controls and policies. I've said something about that. We need to strengthen and finalize more policies and regulations and ensure that we have effective internal controls, adequately resourced and functioning internal audit department that identifies and recommends corrective action effectively. The current unit, the director internal audit, had resigned last year, but even when she was around, there was not a significant capacity in the internal audit unit, and there's little assurance that is given to the accounting officer that the activities are compliant. We've appointed a new audit committee. They've been very active in the last 2 months since their appointment, and they're going to be advising us on how to capacitate. state internal audit, as well as we have advertised the post of director internal audit, and HR has been instructed to accelerate the appointment of directors. Then we've listed on the next slide, and the third last slide, the areas of intergovernmental interdepartment cooperation and integration with CAIA, DHS in terms of housing, basic and higher education to provide education support, and in particular the resolving of the issues within the NSI. We need to both strengthen our relationship with the teachers so that they can assist us in skilling, reskilling, job placement, enterprise development, etc. In terms of DOD, we need to continue to engage with SAMS to ensure a proper level of service is provided to military veterans. Social development, in terms of the issue of SOD and other healthcare and wellness issues. Department of Arts and Culture, we have been working closely with them on the Heritage Liberation Resistance Heritage Roots Program. We've been to Tanzania with them. We want to look at a project we can do in terms of memorialization in Tanzania relating to liberation movement camps there. We're also looking at how they can work together on memorialization inside the country, in particular through the Liberation Youth Program, which has identified sites in all the provinces, many of which relate directly to the veterans. And then, I must say, still largely outstanding is the issue of the Department of Transport and the Transport Ventures. Joint Chairs, in terms of conclusion, we're requesting that the Joint Planning Committee take cognizance of the report and the status and the performance that's reported in relation to the executive authority priorities, the MTS, MTSF, government outcomes, and the NDP. And then come to the last slide, which is thank you. And as you are aware, this is probably the last time I will be appearing before the committee. I really want to thank the committee for the support it's given to the department, for the very constructive way the committee has engaged with the department, and for the assistance you've given us in engaging with the other departments that we rely on. And that has really assisted us. I can tell you that both in DMV and in the other departments, like Transport, CETA, Public Works, when they have to prepare to come to the committee, they really quickly they feel your hand in that regard. I really want to thank you for that, and also on a personal level, I want to thank all members from whichever party for the way you've engaged with me and the organization. And of course, I must thank my team, which has always been helped prepare me. Presentation sometimes presented that you see the quality of the values. And then very lastly, I want to say to the new acting DG, I think he realizes the very tough challenges they're facing in the future in getting these things right in the department. We've gone a small way in trying to lay a basis for what he needs to do, but it's not an easy challenge. But I think I must say, in having interacted with him in the last few days, and also knowing what he's done in the past for the country, that in his service in the post, he's quite capable of this
situation. Thank you very much to you. Thank you very much. Honorable members, before I begin to be so cheerful, but that I didn't know how to proceed in this meeting. I would like to remind honorable members that in yesterday's meeting, the minister committed that should send the deputy minister to come to this meeting. It was a hindsight on their part because the deputy minister is already deployed with some interministerial task team. Therefore, the apology has been rendered.
Thank you, Honorable Co-Chair. Honorable members, you heard the presentation. Without much ado, I'll allow Honorable members to ask questions. And let me thank Mr. Wozinski. Thank you, sir, for the presentation. Honorable Wim, I recognize Honorable Lamene. Honorable Israel, Honorable Skosana, and that order, thank you.
Thanks, Chair, for Chair recognizing the addition of the new name, outcome, acting DG, and we also add to the incoming, to say incoming acting DG. We add the number type. I want to start from almost the last number of issues that I'm going to raise. Outgoing acting DG, this might be your last parting shot. Someone told us to read the book Parting Shots, written by a former ambassador from the community. So it reminded me of you giving us your parting shot. But there are things of importance that I'm really going to mention. Let's start by saying you have mentioned that there are three provinces that have the number of, the largest number of military veterans. That is NK, KZN, and Gauteng. Right? Put that aside. But then you look at the where you have your provincial office. Northwest, Eastern Cape, and Mpumalanga. So you cannot reconcile the two. Where you're supposed to service more people that are there, there are no offices. Why would that be? Is it by choice or by design? Now, this was found in 1994. And what steps are we making to correct it? The second point is, I want to admit I'm always defeated on this point, but I pursue it until it is accepted. It's the issue of leases. Why this? A government will always be there. Why don't you buy or build? This I will pursue until it is accepted. I don't believe that the government is here for 5 years or a year. I believe it is here for millions of years, any country. Now, we are always guided by your vision and mission. And whatever we do in this department. If I were to ask today, or if I were to meet somebody today and ask me, do you think our veterans are dignified, are united, empowered, and self-sufficient? What answer would I give? This is what guides us. As a committee, we are very worried about the military veterans, especially those from the non-statutory forces, because time and age is against them. Look at education. I mentioned that in my budget, there is no uniformity. Why don't we have uniformity? Some military veterans take their kids to private schools, others to public schools. as a government, you need to have just one system. You have mentioned the issue of the database and the verification. We've decided not to put a timeline. But really, we need to finalize the verification. If the issue is personalized, some of us are available to volunteer to finalize this issue. We must have a rough estimate of how many military veterans do we have. If we say 20,000, it's 20,000. But it cannot be an open-ended thing. Let's look at housing. Here we must admit, not much has been done. And we're losing our veterans one by one without shelter. We prefer to take care of them, rural societies, rather than giving them housing. So that's the issue we need to prioritize on. Healthcare services goes back to my first question. I said this in the budget debate. Only three provinces have got military hospitals. How do the six benefit from this? It goes back to my first question. What plans do we have that we have military hospitals in other provinces? You know, there are district health offices, the hospitals that are not working, which we could utilize as military hospitals. Now, a veteran from Northern Cape is ill right now, as of travel. Very far. We pay a lot of money. You have mentioned we still don't have access to transport. So how do we deal with this issue of military hospitals? We cannot be dilly-dallying on this issue after all these years. The last point is the very same one of transport. If we cannot have a finality on the issue of transport, why don't we take some decisions on compression? Speak to the department, speak to the rail, to myself, finalize the issue that the military veterans must have concessions. Speak to airlines. I mean, we shouldn't wait here because we're waiting for the Department of Transport for a long time, ever since the department was established. Lastly, I see the number the department is familiar with is three. It's always three provinces, three hospitals, three that. Is this really how far the department can go? Just end up there from three. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Madam,
thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Let me welcome the presentation. Chair, I don't know where I'm disoriented. I had expected a performance report, but it's difficult to figure out that because maybe it's my expectation. You would want to see if you're using an MTSF. What was planned, what has been done, the expenditure thereafter, or you use an annual performance. But I'm hearing more of strategies and challenges, what needs to be done, and what are the difficulties. But nevertheless, let me ask my questions. I have quite a number of them, so you'll pardon me. My first questions are on the organizational structure. I fully agree with you, Acting DG, that structure follows strategy. My first question is that how often did you check your structure? I heard you saying, this is from, no, it's written, 2010. You've been planning year in, year out. Under normal circumstances, you check your structure. when you submit together with the organizational structure for approval. And I don't know from where I'm coming from, that's how it has to happen, because for you to achieve what you have planned, there has to be appropriate structure or people to support to do what you have planned. But I think the structure was last done 2010. And we are also complaining that the service delivery units or branches are understaffed, and there has been increase in terms of the amount of water. Definitely the structure, which has not been reviewed since 2010, could be the main reason for that. Why it was not reviewed since 2010? Who was supposed to do it? Isn't it the department that was supposed to do? If it is the department, why was it not done since 2010? Then, in terms of field audit, Chair, you want to do skills audit. My question is that why skills audit? How were those people appointed? Were they inherited from other sections? Hence, you want to do skills audit. That is that on the structure. Chairperson, there was an issue of a service provider which has been terminated to provide health care. I'm just checking, Chairperson, what kind of health services that the service provider was providing. Can't it be done through public service? Why a service provider? I'm not sure if I could be clarified on that one. Chairperson, on the expenditure, it goes back to my initial question that it assists when you said acting DG. I agree with you, we have improved in terms of expenditure. But my question, expenditure on what? How do you compare your performance with your expenditure? Can we say, for example, the 100%? Does it mean that you have achieved all what you had planned to achieve? Or is it a matter of spending? I would have more comfortable chair to see performance indicators percentage against the financial expenditure percentage. But I'm missing that information. I just see expenditure, but I'm more interested to know expenditure on what. The other matter is also on the personnel. Compensation of employees, I see you have 99% expenditure. My question is that do you have funded vacancies? If yes, if what would have happened if you could have filled them, because already you are at 99%. I'm not sure if you have them, but my question on that one, Chen, already you are at 99%, if you have vacancies, I don't know what could have happened, Chen. I've already asked the question of the outsourcing of health care services. What is it that cannot be supplied by the government? The issue of SRC, Northern Cape, I'm just using it as an example. Chair, we went to Northern Cape as a committee from the NSOP to do oversight. One of the sites that we visited is a site for military veteran houses. Those people really are suffering. It was so painful for me to see people that compromised their life for us to be where we are today, suffering the manner in which they are suffering. I would want to know, Chair, from the department, under normal circumstances, you would know the status of them. You can only know, you can only update if some of them have improved. I'm thinking that with the issue of social workers, they are your members, veterans from your department. You're supposed to know their status. But can I use my own language? There was one sick person using the oxygen. They had received the houses, which they appreciate. But the question they had that, Chairperson, you have just received these houses. We don't have money to pay for property rates. That's not to pay for our services. The next thing, you'll find yourself owing a lot of money, and how do we then come out of this? I'm glad I'm sitting in this meeting. I think go deeper to these issues. Yes, corruption could be there, but there are real issues there. I met with them. I had to leave what I was doing as oversight and address them. They are really suffering, those people. We need to do something with them. The SRP is supposed to take 12 months. What happens after that? I agree with you. It has to be assessed, checked, whether the status of the person has improved. But I think, Chairperson, you need to, linking with your skills development, you need to have a formal program, because these people are on your database, know their status, come up with a clear, dedicated program to say, these are the people who need support in this kind of skills. We have placed them. They are out of our system in terms of SRD. That will assist you. Instead of depending on social workers. Social workers, hey, we don't know social workers. Social workers, they will make you feel like, some of them, not all of them, of course. The issue, Chairperson, of 114 of them received empowerment in terms of business, we really appreciate that. One of the things that came out in that Northern Cape visit, out of how many of them who need support? Are you linking with other departments? Because it can't be only this department. They could be assisted from other departments and local municipalities. Out of how many? I'm finishing, Chair. I think it's the last one. On the... Okay, I think that was the last one. The last one, Chair, the role of public works. I see you talking about building, doing this. We appreciate. I don't support leasing myself. I support building, because this department will always be there. I support building, but my question is the role of public works. Why are you doing that yourself? You are government, all government buildings, public works is a custodian. Then the last one, women. Chairperson, I've been talking about women. I know also our committee does not reflect that. But Chairperson, we're almost at the end of the term of the fifth administration. I've been seeing about women. It's a men's world. What is it that I'm taking home? The women that I see, what positions are they? Is it a window dressing? Where are the women? That will come up. I've been asking this question since 2014. Is there a progress? If you have improved, I know I've been asking the men's department, but even from your side, I did ask the same question. Is there a progress? How many women, I'm not talking about other years, since I've been here, 2014 until today, I need the progress in terms of appointing women in the senior position. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Chairman. Honorable Lisa.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think the first issue is it's a performance report, and of course it reflects also on what happened the last financial year.
Mm-hmm.
We do see the performance of 97%, and we are aware that the major portion of the money that was not utilized was actually put in education. And that was, of course, shifted because of the need in that particular area, but also the underperformance in other areas like Program 3. Program 3 also reflected that it's supposed to be for skills development and training, and of course placement of military veterans. That particular program was badly performed. So people were not placed, programs were not actually rolled out, and money had to be shifted. Although we also see the amount of money that was put in there, it's far less because of the shifts as well. But those are the two programs of socioeconomic and, of course, the empowerment one. So, yes, the issue of performance is, of course, and we saw the targets. The targets were way off the mark, the planned targets of last year, compared to the actual performance and the payment of staff. We do know there's a serious problem with employing only interns and contract posts to try and manage the situation and using the funded post money to basically subsidize or pay for those individuals. But it was also with the idea that there will be restructuring taking place, and that restructuring, unfortunately, has not been concluded for the last 2 years, and even before that it was discussed, there will be changes. And that's why I don't know why there is such a long delay, and we continue with a large, from 74 people right up to 109 additional posts in the department. So the department is actually dependent on independent and contract, interns and contractors and secondments to actually complement the actual funded post, which is standing now, I'm not sure if it's 150 or if it's 133. The last report in quarter four was 125. So yes, the funded post issue remains and the vacancy issue remains a serious problem. Unless the organogram has been finalized and the changes made as soon as possible, we will continue with the same problems. The other one is, of course, the database. I believe that will roll out on Monday, the 11th. And the timelines, I just want to be assured of the timelines of actually executing it and getting the integrated system in place, and when we'll be able to actually roll it out in terms of the system that we have and identifying the people, subjecting them all to the means test and to all the regulations, and then producing the necessary list of deserving, qualifying military veterans for the various actual benefits. I think this we've been waiting for since the time this department started, and it's always been elusive. We don't achieve it, and this is planned to be achieved by 2019-20. So we hope that will bring some finality to the matter and we can see daylight and not deal with all the different issues of fraud that has taken place in the department. The issue of the ICT, of course, we know CETA is contributing and also OMSCOR to some extent, and they've now completed their part of the task, so CETA is supposed to assist the department in terms of the agreement. The issue, other issue is, of course, internal audit has been extremely disappointing that we identify that as a serious problem for the performance of this department, and also it was qualified reports. And way back it was even a disclaimer. It didn't come up to the stage where it's now unqualified with lots of findings. The issue is that this particular unit that's supposed to play the oversight internal controls of the department, that has always been incapacitated. There's been a director with no real staff to support and to execute the job. So now we hear that there's the process being, of course, advertised. Anybody set up without capacity of a unit or department is, of course, doomed for failure. No one man can run that show. And so I think this is a big concern for us, that this internal audit must be capacitated and must be put in place. Otherwise, we're heading for more trouble. That's why I had a problem with the impact level 3. Because the internal structures were not well organized to actually support to achieve that. The other one, I'm happy that the SAM policy has been concluded last year, procurement is following processes, and we don't have any issues now, procurement and concerns about that, if it's following that due process. The issue that I have also on the education support, as mentioned by our work of the committee, is essentially that we are dealing with the private education at the expense of everybody else. So the gap between normal schooling and between private schooling is a huge gap. Secondly, we've gone into the into first degree at university, which is pegged at 72,000, it may be more in certain instances. But we also find the private colleges, it's not indicated on here, but people are also studying at private colleges, and the payment is not through NSFAS, it comes directly from the department. So we want to make a clear distinction. Do we continue on this trajectory at the expense of all other military veterans, and an increase of to 10,000 in somewhat more bursaries that have to be issued to learners? So, and this is taking up a third of the budget of this department. So unless we're going to make some changes and ensure there's still quality education happening at the end of the day, are we going to have a serious problem that education will essentially take up this entire budget at the expense of everything else? So the issue of addressing the national treasury, the issue of the cabinet reconsidering and increasing the budget, I mean, 100 to 150%, as Mr. Zisk has indicated, becomes absolutely necessary. Otherwise, we're going to fail in dealing with the other benefits. Of course, the concern I also have on the benefits is the South African National Defence Force, which is our current defence force since 1994, the integrated one. And their numbers of military veterans beneficiaries, they're the largest group now. And they're taking in all their children that come in on this. So what structures have been put in place to deal with that issue of people that may just have gone for 6 months or for the 1 year or for 2 years, and they're now coming to the system, and they now, we're looking at all the non-statutory forces before 94, we look at others that have suffered there before, and now we're coming to the national defense. What structures are in place to deal with the current soldiers when they leave the defense? If we're going to say it's all going to be part of this, we currently have 83,000 soldiers in the system. So how do we deal with that backlog issue and those that have been deprived? Remember, the new SANDF are statutory forces. They are not deprived. But because of the economic situations of African unemployment, they have to then make use of the system, and then all others also suffer. So you find many military veterans that are supposed to be registered and benefit are not in the system, but those who are in the current regime, in the SANDF, their children, and they are in the system and benefiting. How does one balance this? How does one deal with this? And what policies were in place when they actually integrated to try and circumvent that they do not get into the military veterans' benefits as planned by this department to deal with the historical backlog that we have? So there's a problem with policy and how we're going to address that issue and deal with also the department and its benefits when people serve this defense and how they serve this defense. So there's a concern on that one. The other one is the healthcare. Of course, it's only access, which means you get a card, you may access. We would like to know how many people actually use that access to get healthcare services. We don't have an actual figure of how many people are actually patients. And that we can only get through the invoices that have been submitted to the department for payment. But to a large extent, as my colleague indicated, if there are 3 military hospitals in the country, then most of the military vets will be considered just indigent and poor and have to go to the state hospitals and state clinics. That's basically what they have to do. So they're not recognized as military veterans. They will just be ordinary citizens, and they have to go queue and wait like anybody else, 350, 400 people a day, every single morning, like anybody else, come back the next day for medicine or the following week for medicines, which might be available only for 1 week, and you have to come back again, because supply is now at 45% or less. So are we going to continue with the system if we say we want to assist military veterans? Does that card authorize them or give them some privilege to be able to access it better than others or quicker than others? Is there a difference between them, or would they just be considered like any other ordinary citizen? So I think we need to find out how we're going to deal with it, because most people will be using the state. The other one, of course, is the service provider. I think that's inevitable. We need to come to some conclusion on that, because it's been going on now for a number of years. A number of years. I'm not talking about one, two, it's gone, it's now three or four years that this thing has been dragging and dragging, and there's no finality on it, and it's got a huge also implication, financial implication, and also liability to the department should the department fail in actually succeeding in dealing with the case. So, yes, we've got a problem. The issue of the state, was there any discussion with Dyla Rye, for instance, where we know that the state hospitals are using a bus service and they actually pick up patients, and particularly if they're chronic patients, they actually fetch them, take them to hospital and drop them back home. Is there any agreement that those military veterans can also access that service, or should they apply as any ordinary patient that goes to hospital for such assistance? The SRD, of course, is a problem. We know that there is now a social worker appointed by the department. And that social worker, I don't know when they actually reach all the different rural areas. There are 5 of them. That's extremely difficult. I've just been to 5 cities to meet with military vets. And this was one of the major problems in the absence, as it was indicated, of a military, of a pension, a military pension. People are dependent, and those who are deserving on the SRD, they have traveled far distances just to come to a meeting in town. And they had to spend that little money they have to get to catch a taxi or to get a lift or somebody to assist them to come address their problem. So transport is a huge problem. It's causing them not to be able to access the benefits and the offices and the service centers that have been established. Although there are 3 officially, I do know the office in Cape Town is operating. There is an office, although not the ideal office. There's an office also in the Free State. Terrence is operating. There's different places. There are people operating, even in KZN. But it's not optimal. And the military veterans are complaining, even those individuals that have been appointed in provinces are not always responsive to the issues that they raise and if they contact them. So there's an absolute urgency to have these service centers and provincial offices established as soon as possible. And that was our concern because the budget indicated a decline or a decrease in that particular area. And I don't know if the money is sufficient to actually secure those offices and to actually capacitate those offices for the balance that is of 6 offices, provincial offices. So the SRD is a problem. The issue is, why is it only from the department? When the Department of Health and Department of Social Work also have social workers, why isn't there some agreement, as we say, intergovernmental relations, to also use their social workers and also at, in the different areas? Because these social workers also travel throughout the week. We divide up the Western Cape, for instance, into 8 health districts. So they have a social worker in each district. So it becomes more accessible than 5 people that have to travel at huge expense to all different areas to actually meet with the military veterans. So can we consider some intergovernment arrangement so that other professional social workers can also assist in this matter and process these applications so that the department can then make the necessary assessment and assist the military veteran where possible? The other issue is, of course, the pension that we spoke about. I believe that there was some draft and there was some consideration now by National Treasury about this, but it appears that regulation and policy has still to be developed. In fact, I saw in Worcester, I received a letter from the GPF, from the, also with the DMV, to indicate a certain amount of money that this pension will pay out to this particular individual. When I read the letter, I said, yes, it is an official letter, but this committee has no knowledge of it and doesn't have any knowledge of a policy that has been confirmed, neither a budget that has been allocated for any. So the department, when they were contacted, they said they made a mistake in issuing the letter. I don't want to put the figures on it. So I don't know what exactly transpired, but certainly it is one of the issues that if you make a decision, it will have a long-term impact until somebody dies if they get a pension. And how do we sustain that? And also in relation to the education that we've got to sustain over medium-term periods, where people will study, if they're from primary school, it may take them 10, 12 years to get through the system and then begin university. So medium to long term, even on the education. Housing, of course, has been disastrous, and I think that service model needs to be looked at and not limited as we proposed previously. I don't think it should be only the model adopted by provincial governments and how they roll it out. There needs to be certain changes in how we can also roll out and also to use military veterans to build their own houses and other models to be looked at and not limited. At this stage, we are underperforming. The 1,000, the 5,000, everything has changed. And even on the 1,000 for the coming year, the last hit was 248 or 200 and someone that were actually built. So we are causing a big problem. And many times the military veterans, if there's a housing scheme built, is completely away from where their families are, and then they say, you must relocate. That's the only scheme that's available. So I think there needs to be far greater communication and interaction with military veterans and how housing will actually be rolled out to assist them. I've discussed the transport. I just want to move on the empowerment. I've indicated the problems with the empowerment and that that programs have not been rolled out. Placement has not taken place. In fact, DMV has failed in that respect to fulfill its targets as well. The honouring of military veterans, burial support still remains a problem. Lots of issues, but I think there also the policies have to be in place. There are quite a few people, and I thank the department for being considerate, that military veterans that are not registered on the system are then registered and then assisted through the burial support. There were those instances, and they had to correct it afterwards with the registration process. But the families, we know, if somebody died in your family, and particularly if it's a military vet, it has a huge impact, even on the military veteran community. How they are being treated, how dignified and how they're honored in life and in death. So I think there needs to be work done so we can process it easily and that we can get people properly registered. But the headstones have had a problem with the cost attached to it. I believe that headstones doesn't have to be they don't have to be that expensive. You can still have high quality. You can still have just who do you get as a service provider, and who does the supply this person with the marble or the stone that is being used for headstones. I put some suggestions to the department. I've sent information through, and I believe that we should not waste money where money can be reinvested in military veterans in other benefits.
Can I wrap up?
So, yeah, let me conclude then. Sorry. I think Sanva also, we've only received in the last 5 years, we only received one report actually, one annual report and one unofficially. And I would like that matter to be also addressed. And what is the actual cooperation between Sanva and the department since the appeal board is in place, since the advisory board is in place, which also consists of military veterans and also connected to Sanva. So I know those has not been a very good relationship. And the budget that has been allocated is actually run by the department and not by Sanva. What are the current status and issues between Sanva and the department? And of course, we hope that can be resolved so that they can actually play the role they're supposed to play. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Honorable Kusana?
Yeah, no, thank you, sir. And greetings to everyone. Yeah, well, I've got just a few questions on the presentation. When you look at on educational support, it's like 15, that indicates that the number of applicants for 2018 academic year on the educational support is 10,557. But the slide does not indicate as to how many were you able to assist out of the total of 10,557. Because I remember that I think in one of the previous meetings you did indicate that the number of applications are far more than your capacity to assist. So just want to find out of this number, were you able to assist all of them? If not, how many were you able to assist? And of the remaining, how are you managing that moving forward? And then the second question on the social relief of distress.
like you indicated, it's also indicated, I think, in the slide number 17, that with the challenge in relation to the issue of social workers, that I think other military veterans, I think they don't want to cooperate and work with social workers. So I just want to find out what is the actual role of the social worker in this regard. And have you, were you able to dig deeper as to what is the reason? Why are they resisting to cooperate with the social workers? Because well, I understand that it is, I think this is as per the policy guidelines, but what is the actual role of the social worker in this regard? And why are they resisting? Because I think that you can't have a common challenge members are resisting to cooperate with social workers. There could be something that we need to find out. And then thirdly, for the issue of pension benefits, my colleague also raised it. I see that we're indicating here that the department's resources are not yet geared for the delivery of this benefit, and that the regulation still needs to be developed, and that the department will consult with other key stakeholders. But what, is there any time frame for this? Think about the pension benefits, I think, think about something very crucial. So is there any time frame that we've attached to this particular program to see how to look at this and deal with it? My fourth question is on the honoring military veterans, where you were indicating that a pilot project on the erection of headstones was rolled out in 2017, and that at least 20 headstones have been erected at the grave of deceased military veterans. So I want to find out that now that you did this particular pilot project, are you therefore now going to continue with this particular project to cover other fallen military veterans? Well, my last question, Honorable Chair, is on the issue of NAFSA. I think we did discuss it also previously in one of the meetings, because I think it's still coming up here, that's on slide number 23, well, NAFSAS and also the Department of Human Settlement. But in particular on NAFSAS, I see that you are indicating that there's a challenge on the reliance and dependency on other organs, say, the Department of Human Settlement and NAFSAS for the delivery of benefits. And on the mitigation strategy, you are saying that strengthening communication with partners and project management capacity is our challenge with NAFSAS. It's just an issue of communication. Is that the challenge? Or there's something more serious that we need to know at the COVID so that we can come in and assist? If it's just an issue of communication, I think it might be, could have been sorted out right now. Because I think last time, somewhere last year, I think this came up as, you know, there's a challenge. So here you capture this just an issue of communication. So I don't think communication can hold us at ransom for such a long time. So we need to understand what is the actual problem, in particular on the issue of NAFSA. Chair, at least I try to be shorter, unlike the my colleague, my previous colleague who spoke before me. I thought he was making a budget speech. That's what I understand.
Thank you, Honorable Member. I don't want to ask a number of questions that I'm having, Mr. Ozensky. But I would just like to know what happened to the turnaround strategy. Why was it not implemented? And how much was spent on the turnaround strategy? Because people were employed, you know, to look at into turning the development around. But instead, we saw protests, sit-ins, and a number of negative things. So if you can at least explain to this house as to what really happened and how much was spent, that I just take us through. Thank you very much. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson and honourable members, for the questions, most of which show an understanding of the issues that the department is facing. What I thought I would do is I can give a more strategic overview in response to some of the questions, and then I'll ask colleagues to respond with more specifics in their own areas. Maybe where I should start is to say that I think the fact that there was a turnaround strategy initiative implemented by the minister in 2015 and 2016, before I was in the department, shows an appreciation of the kind of problems that the department is facing. I think the fact is that clearly the department's resources, human, financial, other resources, are not structured to meet the demands that are on the department. Okay. And the way I look at it is that we can characterize some of these challenges in different ways. From where I've been sitting for the last 20 months, there are some issues that require political intervention. And I'll come and try and list some of those. There are issues that require administrative interventions, and I'll also talk about some of those. And I think that the issues around the department are, if we characterize that in that way, there are also some issues that have to do with, as I mentioned earlier, the systems that were put in place don't meet what was required. And that when there was meant to be reviews of those things, they've been done a bit late. So those issues have kind of built up and interacted with each other and created some of the problems that the department is facing. I also want to say that change management is very difficult in any situation. And I think, like in most situations, you'll get those in the department who see the problem and want to contribute to creating solutions for those problems. But in any situation, you also feel have those who feel that they are entrenched in a certain position and that the change management might threaten the positions where they are in the department. And that creates, at times, resistance to change as well. So it's not one or the other. It's both. You have officials who are very constructive in trying to assist, and then you also have those who resist. And sometimes one official will do both at the same time. So it's a difficult process to manage. And let me say that even the change management is not only sometimes resisted inside the department, it's also resisted from our partners, whether it's Military Veterans Association, individual military veterans, other organizations we've been working with. They, at times, are not happy with the changes that are being brought. Now, there are definitely some areas which I would characterize as needing to be resolved politically. What, amongst which, are the financing of the department. There's only a certain amount that we as officials can do in convincing Treasury to provide more money. In the end, it becomes a political decision, whether more money would be given to DMV or to the SANDF or to any other department that is putting pressure on government. And when I say political, I think it's both the committee, the executive authority, and other political structures that need to play that role. Okay? I'm not saying it's the responsibility of the executive authority, but obviously there are responsibilities there. So then there are also political issues amongst military veterans that needs to be resolved. The one of which is in particular around Thunder and its role vis-a-vis the department and its role in relation to military veterans and the association. The three bodies that are established in terms of that, the Advisory Council, the Appeal Board, and the and Thunder, I think that there are at times different views, whether from the department or from within those bodies, on what the role of the bodies are. Generally, as the officials of the department, we want to function in terms of the laws and regulations that affect us. And the feeling of the department is that the officials must be given the space to implement their responsibilities without interference. However, from the associations, including Sandro, there's a continual pressure on the department to do things in the way they see them. And that becomes very difficult. I think in terms of trying to resolve those issues, I've appealed a number of times to the committee to kind of resolve it, and to help us to resolve those issues. I'll give you the issue of the means test, for instance. Is a kind of symbol of many of these issues. As officials, we have an act which says all benefits must be subjected to a means test. Whilst we were trying to resolve issues around education support and the policy for education, which, let me say, we've been engaging on from when I came into the department in October 2016, right up until now, and the officials had been engaging on this issue before I came to the department. By and large, there's a non-acceptance of the means test from the association and even from the Advisory Council and the Appeals Board. And that puts us as officials in a very difficult situation. We believe in compliance. We read the Act, we read the regulations, etc. We read the public service regulations, the Treasury regulations. We want to comply. The Act says there must be a means test, but we face a situation where military veterans don't agree with it. I really honestly don't believe that as officials of the department it can be resolved. It requires political resolution of that issue. Similarly, when a military veterans association splits, or when there are big issues in the leadership of Sandra, like we've had since the NGC of Sandra in October 2016. There's only a certain intervention that officials can take. And again, what they hear from us is the Act says this, the regulation says this. As officials, we are only prepared to sign off on requests and so on in terms of the Act and the regulation. And we take that very seriously as the leadership of the collective leadership of the party. But that immediately puts us into contradiction with the closest stakeholders of the party. And it requires, again, that broader political intervention. So it makes the situation very difficult. Also, as reflected in the previous audit outcomes, the disclaimers and the qualified audits, there are issues around compliance inside the department, especially on financial issues, that we discovered there, and I think in terms of compliance at that level, we've largely now moved away from issues of non-compliance with regard to financial issues in the department. That's why we've had one unqualified audit with findings, and I'm hoping that for the year that's currently being audited, we will maintain and hopefully improve that outcome. But you can understand, having moved from a situation of quite a lot of non-compliance, and also the need for consequence management related to that non-compliance, it creates a very a difficult situation internally in the department. And I think what we're reflecting is some success. And I think maybe in then now going to some of the detail, which we'll do in a moment, you'll see that there is improvement, but not to the point we can say that those issues are resolved. And I think many of the issues the Honourable Dlamini was raising are actually reflect that kind of problem. Some progress, but not enough to say we now are meeting what our vision and mission is. Just in terms of the TSO, I think the question on the funding of the TSI needs to be directed to the ministry. This is a project of the ministry and it was funded out of ministry funds, not out of TMB funding. But you'll remember that I think it was actually the last time we met the committee was the end of last year. We did a presentation on the TSI. Actually, it was the end of the previous year. I'm losing track of time now. We did a fairly detailed presentation on the TSI to the committee. And what we also did at the end of that presentation was to outline a proposed implementation plan framework for TSI issues. And we have been working on those issues. But I think that we haven't been able to meet the time frame. So I'll give you some of the issues that are raised.
We are saying, according to you, that resides with the minister. But at the same time, they want to respond to it and say a contradiction. Let's leave it. Let's go to other matters. We'll attend to it. Actually, that is why I was unhappy with the minister's response yesterday, because we never touched on this matter. So just leave it there.
But Jay, if I could just say that, like, we have actually been looking at the implementation. So if you look at the issue, say, of the restructuring of the department, it's an issue that's very strongly raised in the key environment. So I just want to say that it's not that we haven't been dealing with it. And maybe you would ask the department, also with the minister, to then come with a progress report on that issue. I'll leave it there.
Yeah, please leave it there. Well, it can be entertained after some time by the newly come in the just leave it there.
I'm happy with that. Chair, then let me also say that I think there's another overall issue which will come up when the amendment bill to the Act finally comes to the committee. The issue is, and I think colleagues have raised this issue as well, what should the focus of the department be? To my mind, the definition of the military veteran in the Act is not very useful. I think the general conception was that when the department was established, when the Act was adopted, that the focus would be largely on the non-statutory forces, given the history where non-statutory forces did not receive benefits while they were serving. Okay. Now, actually the reality is that the definition doesn't help us to deal with that, and the department is really flooded with applications from people who can, in terms of the current definition, be defined as veterans. But I'm not sure that was the intention of Parliament. Okay? And I'll give some examples. For instance, besides the non-statutory and statutory definition that's in the Act, within the statutory forces, you had, for instance, conscripts, white conscripts, into the SADF. Now, there were a very large number of them. I think, my calculation, there could have been even up to around 2 million people who were conscripted into the SADF. Okay. In terms of the current definition, they are regarded as military veterans. And a large number of them have applied for benefits, trying to be registered on the dot list. And clearly the department would not have a capacity if all of them were to apply to service them. And that is something that the changes to the Act must deal with. There are also two other areas dealing with former SANDF members. It's the issue of reserve members and the issue of the STMS members. Am I right with it? The MSDS members, okay? In terms of the current definition, MSDS members would also be characterized as military veterans. However, I don't know if that was the intention of Parliament, both on the DOD side and on the DMP side. And we've had a number of applications, some of which we've turned down, and then those people have appealed to the public protector. And in the engagement with the public protector, it's been very difficult in terms of the Act for the department to defend it. But I don't think it's correct that someone would serve 2 years in the SANDF, even in the SANDF would not be considered to be a permanent member of the SANDF. Yet when they finish their 2 years, they now become military veterans for the rest of their lives and would be able to access benefits for the rest of their lives, including their dependents. There must be something wrong with that position. But the law doesn't help us. So these are some of the issues we've tried to deal with in the amendments. With the reserves, I think it's the opposite situation. The department has a legal opinion which says that in terms of the definition in the Act, it says currently that you must have finished your military training and military service. Now reserves, by and large, have left the SANDF, they've finished their service, but they continue to get called up. And the legal opinion says because they continue to get called up, they're still serving, therefore they're not considered military veterans. And that's really, again, with the former NSF members of the who integrated into the SANDF, but for a large part of their service to the country, received no benefit, many of whom now join the reserves because they are at a disadvantage financially, socially, and so on. So they continue to want to serve, in also, I mean, out of patriotism and loyalty to the country, but they also want to have some income because their pension is not sufficient. But the legal opinion says they're not considered as military veterans. So these are amongst the difficult situations we deal with. And also, it's not just a question of like dealing with it. We have to allocate resources to provide, say, for conscripts, MSDS members, etc., etc. So we urgently need to resolve that. I must say, with regard to the Act, and the colleagues know my frustration. I'm frustrated that we were not able to submit the draft for last year. I'm still submitted that it's not finalized in the department, and it's an urgent issue that my colleague will have to deal with, because without resolving the political and legal issues, some of the administrative issues are not. Colleagues, just to deal with some of the questions, and some of them also have political implications. If we look at the, and I'm going to also ask some of my colleagues to assist. The issue of the officers, I'm going to ask Mrs. Marford to respond on that, because the officers largely fall under her branch, although the procurement is in corporate services. But let me just say that the real problem here is public works. Actually, the request for these officers goes back 4 or 5 years to public works, and public works has only procured 3 of them, and we don't have an ability as DMV at this stage to procure officers ourselves. If we had done that, I think we would have resolved this issue a long time ago. But in terms of government processes, we have to work through public works. And as I said, we met with them 2-3 weeks ago, and the report is as dismal as it's been previously. And the same with the head office. We've long raised this issue with them, and it's only now that they're paying some attention. And again, it's not clear what the outcome will be out of that thing. So there's a serious problem thing that we need assistance with. Whether we build or buy, I must say where I'm sitting, it doesn't really make much difference as long as we get a building that we can use and the money is available. And the difficulty is whether we, because both options are on the table from Public Works, but it's just, given our previous experience, we don't even know which would be a better option. We said we would do a cost-benefit analysis. We still need more information from Public Works on that. But to me, I would rather have the office ASAP. So the cost-benefit analysis is important, but more important to me is whether we'll get the office in 2018 or whether we must wait till 2023 to get an office. Let me also say that also relating to the consultation we do with our stakeholders, issues like are not only around the means test, but also this issue of public and private. We had taken a decision that we should only be providing education support in public institutions, whether they're schools or higher education institutions. But we faced with the reality is, whilst we were trying to finalize the education policy, already many veterans had been given support in private institutions, but also there's a strong resistance amongst military veterans to using public institutions. The perception is that the public don't provide the quality of education that the private ones do. And I think that's an incorrect perception, but it's very strong there. And we actually, the department, in a way, has in terms of the policy that's there now, has lost that battle, because the policies now allow in both private and public institutions. Whereas our view was it should only be in public institutions. However, as I'm saying, in the engagement, we haven't been able to win on that matter. And that's also something I think that Parliament should assist with in that regard. I'll give Ms. Marolo, who's acting DDG in CES, a chance to come in on the detail around how many applications for education support we receive, how we process them, and so on. In terms of housing, this is also a very difficult situation. When I arrived in the department had given money to provinces before the houses were built. But there was also an element of fiscal dumping in that. The money was available at the end of the year, the money was transferred in the last 2 weeks of the financial year. So we stopped that process. We didn't... And we've also been trying to engage with the provinces on the spending on that money. That was in 2015-16. Some of the provinces have now used that money. For instance, in Mpumalanga, they've now finally built houses they should have built in 2015. But other provinces, that money went back to National Treasury because it was unspent in the provinces and then went back. They're unable to access it. That's the one issue. There are some provinces that try and prioritize military veteran houses, but there are others that haven't done that. And largely, these are political issues. For instance, in Gauteng, there were a number of projects, and there are a number of projects where military veterans were meant to benefit, but some of the houses that were completed were then illegally occupied by other military veterans. And that has created also a difficult situation for us to resolve. And again, from where I'm sitting, that those are largely political issues that need to resolve that. We've done our work. We've processed the application. We've had the houses built. We've allocated them to specific people. But other people have now taken those houses. And it requires a way of getting them out of those houses, so they can be allocated to the right people. Other provinces, there's there is also a need for interventions to ensure that more resources are put into play. I agree with the fact that we need to look at the delivery model, but it's not a simple solution. For instance, the issue of getting military veterans to build their own houses is actually quite complex. We have a project in Nelson Mandela Metro, the Chatty project, where the department has allocated, I think, about 300 houses or so. A military veterans cooperative was established to build those houses. That cooperative then started having financial problems and also infighting amongst the cooperative members, to the point where Human Settlement then wanted to cancel that contract with the cooperative. And as DMV, we had to intervene to plead with them not to do that, because it would have worsened the situation. So I'm not sure what the solution is, but it's not simply if we gave it to military veterans to build, it would be easy for them to solve the problem. A lot of this also comes back to capacity in DMV and project management abilities in DMV. Currently, housing is being dealt with by an assistant director who has to report directly to the acting division because of internal capacity problems, these shifts that I referred to earlier when folks were shifted around the department. We're trying to resolve that issue, but it shows you that we don't have enough project management capabilities in the department. The health issue is a big issue, and I think it needs more specific discussions. Marola can say something about that. But one of the reasons we've gone to the province is exactly for the reason that we want to see whether we can use provincial hospitals and clinics to service military veterans. But the engagement with the provinces also takes time. And then to get it down to the point which we want, our vision there is that we would have in each hospital, or in particular hospitals and clinics, a fast-track lane for military veterans. So they wouldn't have to sit in the queue, etc. But to get to that point has been difficult, and we've only really so far engaged two provinces in the specifics of that, and we still need to see the results.
Okay. Thanks for the response. But cement they have taken too long, you know. And with those responses, I don't think we'll find a solution. Honorable members, I'll appeal to you because there are members that they are supposed to catch line. Can we allow the parliament to give us urgent responses on matters that are outstanding? Because we still have to take or continue with the OD on the matters that were raised by the Safety Commission, and that must be out of the same by quarter two. Yes, Honorable Lamina.
I'm finding that except one question in my women. Question of women, if he can only respond on that one. The others I'm fine, he could be responded in that one.
Thank you very much. The question of women, why do we continuously have the boys quiet?
Maybe we should have separate seating for DOD and DMV. Because actually in our executive, we have one DDG who's full-time appointed as a woman, Mrs. Marple. We have an acting DDG, Ms. Marolo, who's also a woman. So that means two out of the three DDGs are women. Okay. And then in the EXCO, we also have acting head of communication, who's also a woman. So at an EXCO level, actually, there's been quite a shift in the competition there. And then in the senior management, we have about 33 or 34% women. And if we look at the target to get to 50%, it's really a matter of appointing two or three of female officials, and then we'd have achieved the 50% target. So there's quite a lot of progress indeed in that issue. And let me state that also some of these women are also military veterans, like Mrs. Martin.
Are you satisfied, Mama? Let's continue. Time is against us.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair of the Joint Standing Committee on Defense and Honorable Members. The Department, we welcome the opportunity to come before the committee to account on the work we are doing.
because we really respect the oversight of the work of the department by Parliament. And I want to also say from the outset that the SANDF, we were happy with the establishment of the Service Commission, because with that we thought they would migrate towards a situation where our unique conditions would be taken into account and we are not
just a second, General. On your presentation, we need to correct something. It's no longer the interim. So, in future, they were appointed.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I was going to come to that, Chair. Yes, as you correctly say, Chair, the permanent SANDF Service Commission has been appointed, and of course, we are doing a very, very difficult job because of necessity, whatever recommendations they come with will have an impact on the compensation of employees' budget, which is currently under severe pressure. Which is why it's becoming difficult for actually the department to actually implement some of the recommendations. In terms of the point that you have just highlighted, it is true there is a permanent SANDF Service Commission. However, the recommendations of the permanent Service Commission we only received from the office of the minister last month, and therefore we couldn't account on those. So the recommendations we are actually accounting on are those that were made by the Interim Service Commission. So that is the status. And of course, we know one recommendation that has been gazetted that we are also responding to, that came from the permanent service.
I beg the General to clarify that point. And our apologies on our side. Correct. If you respond on an interim, and I will wonder why were they sitting in the office of the minister for so long.
Chair, I'm aware of the pressure of time, but I think it is appropriate for me to just quickly introduce my colleagues. I'm with General Ramaswamy from the Planning Environment at the headquarters, and also accompanied by General Sechomai from the HR. Without any further waste of time, Chair, so to allow General Ramaswamy to continue with the presentation, at the end of which we'll then be ready to answer the questions of the committee. And I must indicate that the presentation itself has been structured in the manner that you wanted dealt with. We put the recommendation and we indicate what has been done on that. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, no, you can continue,
Chair. General, thank you, sir. Chairperson, thank you very much. What I will do in some cases, I am going to where there were a lot of recommendations and I can cluster them, put them in one answer, I will do so in the interest of time. Just to start with Honorable Chairperson members, the first recommendation by the Interim Service Commission spoke to the balance between civil oversight. It spoke to the balance between civil oversight and the military command. And it also recommended the fact that the minister and the secretary and the chief of the defense force must find ways and means to produce a definite statement on civil-military relations in South Africa. Now, what has happened, we were faced with this matter, including the project team that has been busy drafting the defense review 20, that was approved by parliament in 2015. Now, it is defensive if you have included in it, in an effort to try and clarify this matter, in Chapter 4 of the Defense Review, civil control as well as civil oversight. And we have gone further to take, to look at the military strategic level, at the military strategic level in terms of demarcating the interaction between defense policy, military strategy, as well as the theater of operations. And that was, in a way, to provide a lot of clarity so that in managing between the Secretariat and the SANDF, there should be clarity in terms of who is supposed to do what in this environment. And what has happened then, in the Defense Force, we have put together jointly bodies that are responsible for that, with the highest decision-making body being the Plenary Defense Staff Council. Decisions from there are then taken to the Council of Defense. But just to take this explanation further, it goes to the second recommendation that talks to the disempowerment of officers commanding. Now, from that defense review and that chapter, honorable members are aware that we are busy with the force design and the model. That one, in a way, moving forward, what will happen is there is going to be restructuring in the SANDF to accommodate the new direction in terms of the structuring of the defense force. And that's where we intend to more empower the officers commanding, i.e., the officers commanding at this stage, they can take command of the human resource element. And our concern is therefore the other element, and the defense review, chapter 14, which talk about defense resource management, specifically says there, in order to deal with this problem, that combat service support must be given to the officers commanding so that they are able to take charge of that. Now, therefore, then, Chairperson, moving forward, the military discipline B is an aspect that we know very easily was presented to honorable members in time, and it is also meant to empower officers commanding over and above the question of mandating them to be able to command all resources which they need to conduct military operations. And in this case, honorable, just to inform honorable members, this bill has been presented to cabinet and was presented to cabinet in the past 2 weeks. Cabinet has referred it back to the department, and what we are hoping for is the fact that by around August that we get it back to cabinet based on what cabinet has directed, and so that thereafter we are able to move with the bill and take it forward. Then, honorable members, this issue of the budget allocation of the Department of Defense, the commission did note here the budgetary constraints which the Defense Force is going through. Chairperson, we want to state the fact that the situation as it stands has not changed that much. What is happening is the department is seeing budgetary cuts every year. And the minister, in a budget vote speech, she did indicate that in the speech of 2017, she clarified the matter, in the speech of 2018, she has done so. Just to give honorable members an indication, only in the financial, in the 2018 MTF, we already have a budgetary cut of 18.2 billion in spend. And that cut cuts across your personnel expenditure, operating, and your capital budget. And that is where we are in terms of the issue with regards to the budget. And I need to say that if I move on to the next slides are also talking about the budget. But just to summarize what is happening there, in terms of the budget, we do have a joint planning team in the department. And that joint planning team synergizes all the planning matters that comes from the various services and divisions. And jointly that is done. And that is done in the defense planning budgeting, by the defense planning, budgeting, and expenditure committee that takes, therefore, those recommendations to the Plenary Defense Staff Council for further endorsement. We have noted the fact that the Defense Service Commission has recommended that the proposed permanent commission be closely involved in the budgeting process insofar as its mandate concerning conditions of service is concerned. The Defense Force Service Commission in this case has got a permanent seat in the HRCC. That is where, in the main, most of the service conditions of the soldiers are discussed. However, they do appear in the Defense Planning Board, in the Defense Planning, Budgeting, and Expenditure Committee, where they also present their own requirements. But the service conditions, in the main, would therefore be discussed in the HRCC. And over and above that, they have got interaction with the Military Command Council and as and when the need arises to do so. And then moving over, then, Chairperson, the next slide talks about the state of defense infrastructure. In this regard, we just they have noted the fact that the defense infrastructure is seriously inadequate, and in many places it is unacceptable unacceptable disregard and in a state of decay. We have noted this, and I would talk to the next one that is just below that in the next column. We have noted this, and then we went on a discussion with the NDPW, a memorandum of understanding which was signed since 2014. That has been done, and that was to make sure that we begin to look at migrating endowment properties back to the Department of Defense with the efforts to establish the defense work formation. And in doing so, Chairperson, what we can report for now is to say that the honorable members have before interacted with the defense works formation, and the progress of the defense force works formation for now is known. They can do some maintenance and repair while capital projects and refurbishment are done by NDPSW, and the reason for that is clearly because of the use of professionals in this regard. But we are moving, and now in the 18th of June, what will be happening is that the plenary defense task council will be getting a report in terms of what is the progress in terms of migration of this NDPW. So that is where we are standing on this matter, Chairperson. And then I will then move over to the professional health support in the Department of Defense. The Commission has noted a few things here. They have noted the fact that the military health support has got a dual responsibility to support the families and the members of the Defense Force. And they've also noted the fact that it is a backstop to the national health system in times of trial. And they've also noted that the current health provision in the Defense Force is deeply compromised despite the valiant efforts of those involved. And Chairperson, just to summarize the answer into this, the status quo remains with regards to health. We've had a time when there was an exodus of the healthcare professionals, and the minister intervened. She intervened and appointed a ministerial medical task team that came up with the recommendations. And some of these recommendations, Chairperson, if I move on to the next slide, some of those recommendations require the fact that we need to do an audit of the various files of the healthcare practitioners where it relates to matters of OLD. And that was done. That was done, and there was also a financial injection into this to the tune of about 100 million. As the current situation as it stands, Chairperson, all of the honorable members, is that we have stabilized in terms of the exodus of the healthcare practitioners. However, there is still a need, as we heard from the presentation of the military veterans, that the military health support still need a financial injection in this regard to be able to bolster certain stock levels, i.e. pharmaceuticals, medical consumables, etc. In this environment. Chairperson, I'll move over to slide number 10. And in slide number 10, we are dealing with the matters relating to transport. In this case, Chairperson, the matters that have been discussed in this one that has been noted by the Service Commission was effective, efficient transport for members of the South African National Defense Force and their families that is required. We have since implemented where we have bought a fleet of duty bus vehicles, and they've been made available to be able to transport members of the South African National Defense Force from the bases to all stations where they are supposed or where they are needed to be able to do this. However, Chairperson, there's a bit of a catch. The warranty has lapsed. Now, with the lapsing of the warranty, now you need funds to do maintenance and repair of these duty buses. And I think that is where for now there is cost pressure, if I may put it that way. And Chairperson, moving over to the next slide, which is slide number 9, there was a requirement to say we need to conduct an audit as far as this transport system is concerned. That has been done. We have done that audit, hence we know the type and the sizes of buses, the number of people that are needed to do that. And so that one, Chairperson, the matter that is in place. And the next one, where the Interim Service Commission recommended that the serviceability, safety and availability of the SNDF transport fleet should rapidly be enhanced, and this inevitably will involve the purchase of more vehicles and better arrangements for the fueling and maintenance. We are complying with that particular recommendation. This last recommendation on this slide, that requires careful examining the potential for using external public and private sector transport. This one, we have written the chairpersons and honorable members that where it is the commander's responsibility. There are a number of variables that are in control of this recommendation, i.e. a person is being transported from Libombo, Palabura, must go to one military hospital and it's only one person. This recommendation supports what the unit commanders are doing at this stage, where in a unit commander will see only one person and you can buy for him a bus ticket. That is doable. Where the unit commander sees that I've got 10 people, on the day they've got medical appointment in 1 minute, and he can provide them a vehicle because they are 10, and that vehicle will be much more cost-effective, cost-benefit analysis, and then he can then take them to 1 minute. So this one, that's why it has been left to the commanders at that level on their own, chairpersons. If I may move from this particular slide, chairperson, and go to career management. Now, I need to say career management, chairperson, we talk about, at some point I'm going to talk about the grievance. The department has done the recommendations that are made here in terms of putting policies in place. And that is what has happened. The policies are in place that would assist in terms of managing the careers, the placement of the people, in the Department of Defense, and not only just to go and place them, but also to be flexible enough to consider and to accommodate members as far as aspirations, as far as it is possible, whilst taking into account as well organizational needs for the job that needs to be done by the Department of Defense. The last one in this slide, Chairperson, indicates that the Commission noted that an effective career management has to have integral to it deliberate systemic methodical system of education, training and development for all levels. We have done it. Now we have done it, it's in place. We have put the learning pathways for various rank levels, we have got learning pathways for NCOs and learning pathways for officers. And this is the policy that has been put in place to develop the members of the SNDF in terms of career development. And Chairperson, on this particular slide, the emphasis of the Interim Service Commission here was based on the issue of the department trying to ensure that we can make our officers and our soldiers to be of international standards by also doing some comparing notes in terms of studies exchange programs with our partners internationally. And we are doing this most notably, the minister mentioned in a budget speech, the fact that, for example, we've got 200 students that are in Cuba, and we also have students in Russia. We've got students, SANDF, in the continent, where they are learning in other colleges of the defense force of other countries. More than that, it's exchange programs where we are exchanging, directing staff. Our colleagues and counterparts in the continent are also doing the same, wherein they do bring some of theirs to come and be with us. And of course, in this recommendation, it also further states that we need to build relations with tertiary institutions. We've done that. It's ongoing matter. We are got relations, for example, with the Stellenbosch. We've got relations. We were to build relations with KZN, however, due to other considerations that must still be done. It was to start next year. In the last financial year, we were with the Defense College, and we also have the University of Johannesburg. And we are also, as well, partnering with the research institutions, not to mention CSIR. I think most of the government departments are involved in this. So this recommendation is taken seriously, and it's a recommendation which is being implemented in the department. And Chairperson, then moving on to military skills development, just to summarize what the recommendation was being said, the recommendation was saying to us that we need to consider the not only the military skills development system, but we also need to look at youth development, especially for those youth that may not have access to academic institutions such as the universities, etc. Chairperson, honorable members, we have indicated the fact that we take the MSDS as a primary system that we can use to rejuvenate the FANDF. And I think the Commission acknowledges this fact. However, Chairperson, there is a lot of things we, the Department of Defense, is doing at this point in time. One of them is to partner with the Department of Education, the Department of Rural Development, in ensuring this very requirement, recommendation about youth development. The SA Army, for example, Chairperson, had what is called the Young Lions. The South African Air Force has got what is called the Young Falcons. Now, these Young Falcons, they will be coming in now in June, July. The South African Air Force will be having them, and we also have the Naval Cadet. And over and above that, which is something which is any government department is doing, and the Defense Force is doing that, and that is internship. I just need to say, Chairperson, whilst we are busy with this program that I've just mentioned, in the Army it has slowed so much, such that the Army has not been doing these Young Lions. This is where we partner with the Department of Education, making sure that we can visit secondary schools, we can take those students during the school holidays, and we can make them part of the military, putting them in certain camps, telling them what a CMN is and MN is, teaching them certain things. Where we've got some members who are teachers who are good in mathematics, that will be a subject that we will be dealing with. Internship representatives have indicated, I think every department is doing this one. So what we are saying in short, there's a recommendation. If not restricted by financial constraints, when we've got budget cuts, you obviously look at which issues can I deal with, which may not impact on my core mandate. National Treasury is good in managing the budget cut. They will always say to us, reprioritize within your budget. Now, when you have to reprioritize, you go and check, oh, I don't have to so much collapse of reserve. So they are only impacted on by the budget cut, so to say, Chairperson. What I have done in the previous slide, I have provided a summary of these recommendations, because in the main, they are talking about the very same MSDS system, which I'm talking about, and with all the responses that we have put in that slide, they are re-emphasizing the point that I was making, the MSDS, that is meant just to rejuvenate the SANDF. And I've dealt with the last word in terms of where the in terms of the training. The officers, MSDS, that have completed the formative training successfully, that they need to be commissioned. Indeed, this is the policy in the Defense Force. Now, when they have to be commissioned, they will be commissioned. And that is an ongoing matter in the DOD. Chairperson, on the issue of transformation, somehow this recommendation is being repeated. And I've already dealt with it. This recommendation still talk about the subject of where not us only taking MSDS, but also doing youth development. And I've covered it in the previous slide. It has been repeated. We didn't want to omit it. We took it as part of those transformation measures. Now, the Interim Defense Force Service Commission also recommended that the SNDS conduct a systemic audit of its transformation achievement, and particularly with regard to the match between the force and the demographic characteristics of the country. Chairperson, in our recruitment policies, are written in such a way that they take cognizance of the demographics of the country. The only challenge is, whilst we have that in our policy, the only thing is that it is voluntary. So you might want to have an intake of so many, but the system itself is voluntary. However, our policies do take cognizance of that. And in the second row, in the middle row, the chairperson, they recommended that the relevant parts of the legacy decision with regards to ranking and utilization be reviewed by the SANDF. We are doing this thing through carrier in management and through grievance system. In a grievance system, any member of the South African National Defence Force can indicate where he or she was disadvantaged, especially during the time of integration. As we were integrating, of course certain decisions were made, which is what this recommendation is referring to. Now the members of the SANDF can say this is what has happened and therefore can raise that through the grievance process. Not only that, but management can make a consideration through career management and say that this needs to be corrected. So what we are saying is that this is permissible within the department, and there can be management intervention, and a member can bring in this case, the grievance himself or herself. Now, the next one talks about the discriminatory force numbers. After integration, those who integrated newly were given new force numbers, and those force numbers were at a certain point, became a problem in the defense force, wherein the members that got integrated into the system, which was then the SADF system, felt that they were being discriminated on certain things on grounds of the utilization of force numbers. Chairperson, I want to refer members to the last sentence in the current status, the way we said that the perceived discrimination is time-lapsed. What we are saying is moving ahead with the issues of addressing the demographics, the issues of making sure that as we have integrated, there can be then be there can be right sizing of placing, so that the department at all levels is a representative of South Africa and the forces that have integrated. And we take this the force numbers as an ID of a person. It is not only linked to the systems within the DOD, it is linked even outside of the DOD, GPS as an example. But then we are saying that as far as this is concerned, it is our belief that if we were to start a survey, most probably this may not come back again as a problem where we stand today. Then, Chairperson, just to go to slide number 18, where is the grievance mechanism within the Department of Defense. And when the Interim Service Commission was making this recommendation, there were already efforts that were being put in place to start the grievance mechanism. And that is why in this particular slide, they are commending the fact that they've noted that the department is starting this and requested that this new system is expedited. We can report, Chairperson, and honorable members are already aware that the grievance system in the Department of Defense is operational. And maybe just to point out in 3 to 4 seconds, the fact that the grievances in the defense force, they revolve around issues of cross attendance, promotions, transfers, and many others around that. Now, the challenge in some areas, for instance, if you talk cross attendance, just to give honorable members a feel of that, is that as we go through the budget cut, what is happening is it is affecting career development of people where you must develop them by sending them to various military courses, because the defense force inherently it grows its own timber. Now they are being affected. Then you find that we've got a backlog, so a few can go on courses. And while this is happening, therefore, then it obviously creates unhappiness. You don't have the resources to make sure that you can build a number of courses to take them through. As an example, as one of the issues. So the grievance centers around this area, but the grievance management system, Chairperson, honorable members, it is in place. Now on the issue, which is the next slide, that is slide number 19. On slide number 19, Chairperson, we want to report the following. In this slide, the method of command, control, and communication, with the unit. The visits that commanders need to do to units and to communicate more with a subordinate unit. In this particular one, Chairperson, we know the fact that there was also the issues of the facilities which have been mentioned. But we are indicating the fact that the commanders, they frequently do go to units. But again, it must be pointed out, and it is the responsibilities of the commanders to make sure that they visit this unit and they communicate frequently. But we need to point out that as they visit the unit, surely with budget cuts, you also want to consider that. You want to restrict certain activities from happening. We do not want to restrict in the areas that will compromise the need to communicate with the soldiers. But at some stage, this gets affected when you've got frequent budget cuts that are taking place. The issues in terms of the facilities, which is indicated on the same recommendation, is an ongoing and is also dependent, again, on budget allocation. Just to point out the fact that in our annual performance plan, we do indicate which facilities in the medium term are going to be attended to, what is the amount of money that is allocated. And we are aware of the fact that the rents and cents indicated there may not be sufficient in some cases, as well as the fact that not all of those projects got to find their way into the annual performance plan. Then, Chairperson, I would want to say that I've addressed the top bullet because it is a recommendation on the issues of the facilities once again, which I spoke to in terms of what we have in terms of the annual performance plan with NWCW, of course, and the defense force formation that is being set in part of the maintenance in this regard. Now, the last one which is indicated there, that indicates that in the light of the revised and enthusiastic commitment by the SNDF leadership to ensure that bases are systematically visited by senior officers, as I said, it is done on a continuous basis, and that is the point which I've just spoken about. Then on the issue of promotions and utilization of the members in the DOD, Chairperson, the Interim Service Commission has noted that the current system of promotion and utilization of members is dysfunctional and lacks respect by a large number of the SANDF members. And then it also noted the fact that there are issues around the proper exit mechanisms into jobs in the rest of the public service that needs to be attended to, or to the private sector. And we just want to say, Chairperson, although this has been a problem, we have made an intervention in this. The policies that we spoke about, and annually what we're doing is that we are promulgating the guidelines on an annual basis, and also what we are doing is that we are doing career, we are providing members with career questionnaires where the members themselves are able to indicate to us their preferences in terms of the next placement, and so on and so on. And like I said in the previous one, we do consider the members a requirement in this case, though taking into account organizational requirements. Then, Chairperson, they recommended that the SNDF review its whole system of promotion and utilization in order to develop radically effective measures to achieve a fair, transparent, and efficient method of using the services of all its members optimally, and of ensuring that those who leave the service are properly trained and counseled in order to get working jobs in the outside. That last part is the one that I want to talk about, because the previous one I've already explained it, where we provide guidelines and career questionnaires and the policies are in place. But on the last one, Chairperson, any member who wants to leave the Department of Defense is provided an opportunity for it. That is done. And as they are provided this opportunity for reskilling, they've got a choice to make. We have had instances where some of the members have chosen not to. But what we are seeing today is that an increasing number of the members are choosing to take up these opportunities in terms of the reskilling. The next slide, which is slide number 22, I'm going to summarize the Defence Force Service Commission's requirement. There were head members who have demilitarized, who were managing the finances, they were members of the SNDF. They demilitarized and became civilian members, those still in the Defence Force. Now, when they demilitarized, obviously, their pension were affected because of the fact that their employer now is the Department of Public Services Administration. And that, therefore, then affected their pension. That issue had to be resolved for those members. It has been a long way. And we are here in Chairperson to report the fact that it was in the 28th of February where this was finally ratified in the General Public Service Sector Bargaining Council. And the Principal Executive Officer was informed in March 2018 that the DOT has adhered to all the requirements to reinstate the pension benefits, and the administrative processes will then be followed hereafter. And that was only now in February. But it has been a long way, Chairperson, and finally, we are happy to report that this matter has been attended. I will do the same, Chairperson, to summarize the wellness of the department. Well, the Interim Defence Force Service Commission recommended the fact that the wellness program and the health and wellness program in the Defence Force has to be implemented. And what has then happened is that, and this was to be able to support the soldiers and their families, what has then happened, a multidisciplinary team has been established with the chaplain, with the military health service, where you've got social workers, with members of the HR division being part thereof. And what has been happening, Chairperson, is that this team, there's been progress that has been made. Pre-deployment resilience is being given to them. During deployment, resilience is being given to them, and post-deployment resilience is being provided to members of the Defence Force with this particular team. So there has been a lot of achievement. We have indicated there that there's been an instruction that was written with regards to the health and wellness program. And that is the instruction which currently is being followed, and it is working at this point in time. Chairperson, I will then move. I've already explained this slide. It is the resilience program which is being given. That is just to indicate some of the achievements in the past 3 years which have been noted in the slides over there. I'll then be moving over, and I am in slide number 25, Chairperson. In this case, it is the review of the force number allocation system for members and employees of the Department of Defense. Everything that is written there, it's what, Chairperson, I have indicated when I explained the issue of the force numbers during integration. So in a way, I have covered this slide. It's just that most probably it's being repeated, but now with a bit of details where they wanted us as well to do the costing in terms of making sure what will it cost for us to implement those force numbers. But as we said, Chairperson, we brought in that statement there that says that the perceived discrimination is standard. We are not of the view that should we conduct a survey in terms of changing of the force numbers, that there will still be the same problems as they were. And the problem is these force numbers are linked, not only in the Defence Force, but even to other institutions outside of the Department of Defence. And Chairperson, if I may move over then to the issue, because the top column, the top row there, it was speaking to the full-time and part-time commissioners. And what we have just said there is that becomes the national treasury that has got the responsibility for the service conditions and remuneration of members of the Defence Force Service Commission. And we are saying, Chairperson, in terms of the improvement of conditions of service for members of the medical, of the Presidential Medical Unit, Chairperson, there was the issues with regards to the structure, which is what they've noted. Secondly, the issue with regards to the use of civilian clothes, which the members that are going with our principals, they need to be dressed properly. And there was the issue with regards to the allowances. We are reporting, Chairperson, that the allowances, as well as the civilian clothes, has been provided for. Where we stand in terms of the structure, Chairperson, we do have a virtual structure, and that is the structure which we are using for the members of the Presidential Medical Unit. Now, why a virtual structure, Chairperson? We have got this thing. The HR budget, when it is given to you, they will say that it is specifically and exclusively appropriated. And more often, that budget would have been cut. Now, if you want to do an approval of a particular structure, you've got to follow the process where you say that this structure has got money that I can fund this structure. Yet your HR budget has been cut. However, we are operating in the PMU, with the PMU. We have got a virtual structure which we are using, and that's the structure that is working at this point in time. And the rest of the issues, as were in the recommendation of the Defence Force Service Commission, has been taken care of, Chairperson. I have actually, by so saying, Chairperson, I have summarized a few slides here. Because there is a defense, a South African National Defence Force order that was given by the Chief of the Defence Force, in which he is catering. Now, in this particular slide, number 27, on the top row, we are merely indicating the fact that there was a Defence Force order in this regard. Now, on the next one, Chairperson, all what we can say is that what the Interim Service Commission has identified, which is the fact that the members of the Presidential Medical Unit are an integral part of the security personnel surrounding our principal. We support that statement 100%, and that is how serious we look at the statement as well, and we are happy that the Interim Service Commission has noted that recommendation. Chairperson, with your permission, as all this is all about what they have noted, and then they later on go to make recommendations on the three issues which I have just spoken about. And like I said, all three have been taken care of, with the exception of the structure, because what we have, we've got now a virtual structure which we are operating on. Chairperson, I would want to talk about this recommendation, which is, it is the last of the slides. We have taken this one, Chairperson, because we wanted to make honorable members aware of some of the efforts which the department has tried to do in view of the Defence Force Service Commission recommendation. In this case, the recommendation by the Defence Force Service Commission was that there must be a once-off allowance for 15% of SNDS members who are stagnated in rank, and the option of implementing grade progression system as an interim measure, while a unique SNDF dispensation framework is developed that will be in line with the defense regime. And secondly, which is below, the SANDF is to develop a pay progression for reserve force members, which will allow members to progress to the next notch after 12 months of cumulative service in rank. The last one is work in progress. Noting the fact that the recommendation was given to us June 2017. However, on the first recommendation, Chairperson, we were so much in support of that recommendation, and we have taken that recommendation seriously. We have moved with that recommendation, and we took the word correspondences to National Treasury in this regard. However, unfortunately, National Treasury could not support that recommendation. My colleague will explain further what was that. But just to summarize what was the National Treasury's feedback, they had a problem wherein they indicated the fact that there was an HR deficit. The issue with this recommendation, Chairperson, has got to do with the fact that there are members since integration who have been in the lower rank. In the main, Chairperson, you find that there is no mobility for them, and then the Defence Force Service Commission finds that it was necessary for the department to continue. Would there be a certain notch? And this, the department was to do in consultation with National Treasury. So it was not; it was something which we were saying let's consult. But however, then there was a bit of we couldn't find a way to implement it. Chairperson, I will hand over to the Chief of Staff, General Mufondo. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and honorable members. for the opportunity to respond as to what is it that we have done as a department to try and implement the recommendation of the SANDF Service Commission. We're at a point now where we're ready to answer the questions of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members,
thank you, Honourable Chair. I think the recommendations have been pending for a long while, and certain of the recommendations can be implemented, and others, of course, we can understand. There are huge financial constraints, and that makes it very difficult for us because over the MTF period, there's going to be a cut, and every year there's a billion that must also be cut in addition to the normal cuts. So I don't know what to say as a committee, where we're going to go with the recommendations, because it's a tough one. We'd like to see the best conditions prevail in the Defence Force, and of course in terms of uniform equipment, of pay, of benefits, of facilities, we support that. It's just how does one deal with the current situation? The issue of maintenance was one of the ones that, as we visited the different bases, we were appalled at some of the conditions of the facilities that the soldiers have to actually live in, particularly the ones that are more junior. And of course, can those things be addressed immediately, because it impacts on the morale of the soldiers. So, and I think the idea was also to use the military veterans that have now formed also part, and within the defense itself, those who became the worst regiment, and the achievement that they have gained by reducing the cost to the department and able to do more work. Can that program be expanded to cut costs but to improve the conditions of soldiers as soon as possible? The other one, of course, is a major concern, is that soldiers are working within defense. They're employed in defense, they got a job in defense, but the understanding is that they don't do anything to clean their place and to fix their place. And I think that approach has differed from what historically the case was, where soldiers were also developing their own skills, and whatever they have of arts and crafts, and that they could use those skills while they were also soldiers in the defense force. These days, we find that the toilet is broken, the pipes can be leaking, and the person will sleep next to it, and he won't do anything about it. Somehow we need to address that. We cannot let that situation persist. That is not the type of soldier where you are, you keep yourself clean. I mean, that is regardless of who you are. And I think this is a serious problem, because even basic repairs that can be done by individuals, and that I can even do myself, we don't need professionals to do it. That is not even being seen to. Cutting of simple thing of grass, things are growing, is only when we can pay a visit you find there's some physical changes that happened the day before. It's not grass that is cut regularly and things that are cleaned regularly. And I think this is very sad for a disciplined military to adopt such an approach where it's actually lackadaisical and it's negligent of its own conditions and the facilities that they occupy. Nonetheless, we need to cut wherever we can the cost and improve the conditions. That is the way we have to go. And I think this is across the board. The recommendations made by the Commission, we've always appreciated that. It's been direct contact with the individuals on the ground, the challenges they have, what they experience, what they would like to see improve. And it's all to improve and create this defense that we are proud of. That's what we all want. The Commission plays their role. the defense plays their role, the DOD. We play our role, and we all go in there to improve the conditions to make it a better defense force. The other one which is always a concern is the MSDS. What the minister has reported yesterday, there's a natural attrition which is taking place about plus minus 4,000 per annum. If Treasury is asked that we need to cut about 16,000, that will be achieved over a four-year period if it's taken now. If you took the previous year, it will take 3 years of the MTF. So do we institute a MEMS, which could be very, very costly, because you have to make an attractive package to give to people, unlike if it's a normal attrition, where the person retires and leaves the force, and then, of course, the benefits are far less. It's just the normal benefits. It's not benefits to try and get rid of people. And you have to make it attractive to get rid of them. So I think that was the argument, is that do we want to waste more money on MEMS, or do we want to follow a natural attrition that is plus minus 4,000 per year, which will reduce the force if we don't employ others in their place. But also with the caution that we do not just allow people to leave, but also look at the critical skills that are required to continue within the force and the transfer of those skills to the younger ones. In direct relation to that is the MSDS, all our young soldiers that we are training, that's under 4,000 per year. But the percentage of them being employed now and absorbed into the system is a serious problem. They are actually unemployed. They are being trained to be soldiers. So somehow we need to balance to rejuvenate and get young blood in, because the age has gone up to 32 to 34 now, when the reserves has gone to 40. I mean, if it's not over 40. So we cannot, that situation we have to manage. Otherwise we're going to have a very old defense force. People that cannot actually fight and run in the bush, but they can, of course, organize and plan. And I think we need a balance in that. Less people on top, more people at the bottom to actually do the work. So I think it's those balances that I'm worried about that is not being seen to. We still continue to train the MSDS. We still continue not employing them. And there are serious complaints of them. They're walking the streets. They qualified. They got degrees. They are trained people. And there was also caution raised by the minister. Do professional soldiers also get involved in criminal activities? If they leave the force and they've been in the force, they've been trained, have we investigated that to see if there's any link between highly trained soldiers and criminal activity? And she mentioned in particular the cash heists that have taken place and increased in South Africa. The reserve force, I know there's an issue of having people on standby, but as long as people are in the reserve force and they're not employed, meaning going out for 6 months or 12 months a year, it means they're effectively not earning anything. And there are those that are saying, do we actually opt to become military veterans, or do we stay as reserve force members? And there seems also to be some discrimination that certain people are preferred because they are called up for duty all the time and others are not called up at all. So how does one rotate the system to keep the reserve force active and to keep them also trained and in a condition that they can actually serve whenever there's a crisis? I think that is a concern I've got with the reserve force and how they are actually being rotated. Yeah, I think the final issue, of course, if we have a large regular force, and we can use that because they're employed and they're paid permanently already. They're in the force. Do we use the reserve force now to supplement when we have soldiers that are not that active within the force? Are they all being put to good use? If we say we have 83,000, including the PSAP, are they all active members? Are they really working within the force, or some of them just occupying seats? And I think we need to know how much money are we really spending on soldiers that are doing work and soldiers that are just there, superhumanly. So those are things that I'm concerned about, that money is not wisely invested. We can save money, we must save money and reinvest. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sam. What I suggest, you must note all those concerns. We expect you, when you come back, to talk to us as to how we are any questions that need answers. said that to the pastors that also should. I think we should take it that role. Thank you very much. I'll leave you like that.